Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you're doing well. I'm Patrick Casey, sitting in for Henrik Palmgren, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. Our guest for today is Frame Game Radio, a well-known Twitter personality, YouTuber, and attorney. He supports white identitarianism and believes that if identity politics are to be allowed, all racial and ethnic groups should be able to participate without suffering social consequences. Welcome to Red Ice, Frame. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Before we get started here, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I am Frame Game Radio, and I am a white identitarian. I have a Jewish background and have practiced as a corporate attorney for many years. And I try to bring a somewhat unique perspective to the identitarian issues that everyone in this movement is involved with. I think both because I have a somewhat unique life history, although I guess everyone sort of does in their red pill journey, but also because having a Jewish background, I've sort of seen the Jewish side of identity politics, and balancing that with the white identity politics angle is something I've long been sort of fascinated by. And you know, I consider myself to be a whistleblower of corruption in the diversity industry. And so my vision is to make identity politics something for every group or for no group. And that has led me to the conclusion that there needs to be a strong white identity politics movement, both nationally and internationally, in order to bring about radical love and equality, if you will.
Nice. So how did you come to develop these views?
I came to develop these views, I think, as most people do, through the long and winding road of life when you run into something that that is logically non-falsifiable, and you start trying to falsify it. And over the course of trying to falsify it, you sort of harden in your belief system that this thing is actually true because you've simply been so unable to disprove it. It started for me, I guess, with a bit of a bang in college when I didn't want to be a lawyer initially. I wanted to be an evolutionary psychologist. I mentioned this on an interview with Greg Johnson last week, which is that my story is somewhat funny in that I found David Buss's Evolutionary Psychology, A New Science of the Mind, between my sophomore and junior year of college, and I was so fascinated by it that I wanted to share it with the world. And at the time, I was extremely disenchanted with the humanities and the social sciences. I went to an Ivy League college, and I had great grades, I was magna cum laude, but at the same time, I felt that I was getting less of an education in college than I had gotten in high school because the social sciences were so obviously devoid of the scientific method. Everything seemed to come back to diversity, even when it had nothing to do with it. So, you know, these were during the Bush years where I was struggling to find my identity politically. In high school, I considered myself liberal, but not very liberal, just kind of middle-of-the-road liberal. And I found myself searching for an identity because I knew that that's not what I was. I didn't fit in with the sort of white hatred that was sort of the entry pass to fitting in an academic department. I wanted to be an academic. And what I found is that I saw evolutionary psychology as the answer to the various crises happening in psychology and sociology and anthropology. And this was before the replication crisis. Mm-hmm. That struck the social sciences, where something like 70% of peer-reviewed papers are non-reproducible, and probably a lot more than that due to the file drawer effect. But I knew something was wrong because I kind of had that, I was feisty, I guess, even then. I couldn't let it go. And when I found evolutionary psychology, when I found this David Buss textbook, it was like fireworks going off in my brain where everything became crystal clear. It was like, okay, now we have a framework for dealing, for connecting psychology to biology. Now, finally, we're not talking about Freud. It was 60 years ago, right? Like, nothing had been accomplished in psychology. I had been fascinated with the human mind, and it had been a dead field. Yet every single university in the country taught it. But it was a dead field because they had to toe this political line. Everything in psychology had to conform to diversity politics. And I can get into some examples of that. But the short story is, I couldn't keep my mouth shut once I found evolutionary psychology. And I told everyone within earshot, including my professors, and I found myself being shocked at the reaction that me seemingly, my enthusiasm for the field of psychology ended up being the thing that got me largely blacklisted from it. I was told that I wouldn't be able to get letters of recommendation despite being a straight-A student. I basically got the memo that if I wanted to try to be a academic in evolutionary psychology, that it was going to be a very, very rough road for me. And so I decided an alternate career, but I always came back to biology, and I always came back to the evolutionary psychology, even during my law school years. And that led me down the road, that many in this cause, know very well as being race realism and gender realism. And I found it all to be beautiful. To me, there was nothing really subversive about it. It was just human biodiversity is amazing. And it seemed like if everyone understood this, this would be a way to decrease animosity between genders and between ethnic groups. But it, instead, this was the hidden knowledge that no one was supposed to know. And I refused to let it go.
You've been quite vocal about the fact that Jewish individuals and organizations disproportionately support globalism. As someone of Jewish heritage, was it hard coming to this realization?
I'll tell you why it wasn't hard. It was actually very seamless because I had positioned myself, I guess, more and more towards the worldview that I have now for many years, and it was always something that was humorous and cheeky to my friends. It was something that was, I guess when you do it with a sense of humor and you do it with that shit-eating grin, so to speak, you can get away with a lot that way. So what's the saying? If you're going to tell someone the truth, be funny or they'll kill you. I took that to heart, and it really wasn't. I always sort of rode the line with those issues, but it was really the Trump election that I would say pushed me into full-fledged advocacy in a way that's sort of point of no return level, like the kind where you realize just how important everything is and you need to start reprioritizing things because you realize that the world you're leaving to your grandchildren simply won't exist if you ignore it. So I consider myself to be a little bit of a Chicken Little trying to convince as many people as possible about the threat of the sky falling down, so to speak, because it's now or never. I mean, we can get to the specific substantive issues that I'm talking about here, namely demographics and nuclear level identity politics. But really with the JQ specifically, I don't know. I've always sort of had faith in my ability to advocate my way out of social situations. And you know, so I guess there are two prongs of it. One is the substantive prong. How did I like actually realize what was going on? And then the other one is how do you handle it in your social life and in your personal life? And the first one is easy, right? I mean, I was bar mitzvahed. I spent, you know, so 10 years in Hebrew school, bar mitzvahed, another 2 years, and then got confirmed. And, you know, grew up going to a Shabbat club every Friday and was very steeped in Jewish life. It was, you know, I think part of it was understanding once I started to put the pieces together about identity politics generally, there really didn't seem to be a difference between Jewish identity politics and Black identity politics. And to me, what was most sort of instructive, I guess, was learning to see things beyond left wing and right wing. I found myself, in terms of my sort of JQ awareness, I would say the thing that really opened my eyes to a whole new world was recognizing that that right-wing Jewish politics generally amounted to kind of neocon Zionism, and that it had much more predictive value when you started looking at the ethnic component rather than just the liberal versus conservative component. There are all these data points that get filled in when you look at it that way. And I am a radical, free speech, free data person. And I found myself having a competitive edge when trying to predict future events, including the rise of Trump, because of the willingness to really be scientific about how the world works, including the ethnic components.
So if Jews or other ethnic groups wield disproportionate amounts of power and influence in the West, are they to blame, or is it the fault of white people for allowing their institutions to be subverted?
I would say that there's certainly an element of both. And, you know, I try to stay away from the blame game. But, you know, that's not really my job as I see it. Mine is to provide facts and compelling stories and let other people sort of weave what they will with it. But I would say that, you know, as a proud Jewish person, I don't think that it's Jewish people per se, you know, that should be demonized in any way. I see it as the organizational capacity. That is, you know, so organized Jewish influence started in America in about 1838. That was with the first B'nai B'rith Lodge. And there are four waves of Jewish influence, right? There was the 1830s, which was B'nai B'rith and Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. And then the 1890s, there was the Zionism, and then the flexing of the political teeth of B'nai B'rith. And then in the 1920s, there was an absolute explosion in Jewish identity groups. This is everything from ADL to the American Zionist Council to the Jewish Agency to the, you know, Council for, you know, the American Jewish Presidents Conference, the Board of Governors, I mean, the list goes on and on, right? I mean, we're at the point now where there's literally thousands of Jewish identity organizations. But they really, they took on what you might call the element of corruption in really beginning in the 1920s. And I'm not so sure that it started out with the levels of corruption. It may have started out with very benign intentions. And then I think what likely ended up happening is, those major players in those organizations sort of thought they were doing something by functional necessity and then realized as time went on that they had a mega powerful weapon in their hands and refused to let it go. So I think that the best way to describe this is to say that, you know, there's that great quote, every great cause starts as a movement, becomes a business, and degenerates into a racket. I think that the Jewish identity movement, which really started in the 1920s in full, became a business by about the 1940s and 50s, and by the 1960s, and certainly as of right now, is in its degenerated into a racket stage. It is a full-fledged mafia organization. I mean, there's simply no other way to describe it if you're being honest right? If you're being political, you can dress it up and you can talk about just the elements of it that are criminal or the elements of it that are corrupt or the elements of it that are distortionary. And I do think that many elements of it should be saved. To the extent that you're talking about endorsing white identity politics, then I think that certain elements of Jewish identity politics should be retained. It's just that you can't have it both ways. And you certainly can't have it both ways with no sunset clause. That is, with no ending date to it, right? So a common thing in contract law is to have something called a sunset clause, which is like, okay, as an analogy, you know, affirmative action for 15 years and then it's over, right? That's what Justice Ginsburg, I think, said in Grutter versus Bollinger, that they would hopefully revisit, I think it was Grutter versus Bollinger. I'm not sure of the exact case. I forget now. But, you know, where she said, you know, this is hopefully going to not be the law in 25 years, right? Of course, that's, I think that the sunset for that is well long gone. And there was a great memo that someone whose name escapes me wrote to Harvard about affirmative action, which says, one moves smoothly and transparently into a world where that affirmative action is necessary because it is too weak, because black identity groups are too weak, to a world where affirmative action is necessary because black identity groups are too strong. And the same thing happened, no doubt, with Jewish identity politics. And we're now living in that post-control world and having to navigate the identity politics of it. But it has to be called out. It just has to be.
Agreed. Definitely. So I've talked to a few Jews who are sympathetic to the alt-right or, you know, share many alt-right identitarian positions on a number of issues. And most of them are under the impression that the ADL and other Jewish organizations that ostensibly combat anti-Semitism and generally support, you know, open borders and globalism overall, all of these institutions, despite the fact that they're working towards the ethnic interests of Jews, are actually creating a worse situation for Jews. Are you someone that would agree with something like that?
I would agree with it. In a best case scenario, I would agree with it. The way I see it is this, right? There's sort of three different spin-off scenarios. One, which is what initially turned me towards embracing white identity politics, which is that it seemed like it would be horrible for Jews to have this world where these high trust white Gentile societies are totally destroyed through becoming politically disenfranchised by becoming a minority and losing their cultural hegemony, having the West, you know, having America be majority Mexican, having Europe be majority Muslim, and having Canada be majority refugee. I mean, you fast forward that situation and every single one of those groups dislikes Jews a lot more than white Gentiles do. And not only that, seem to be very much immune to attempts to the same sort of ADL tactics do not work as well on Jewish and black and Mexican groups. They just don't. And that's something that Stephen Steinlight lamented in his 2001 article, The Jewish Stake in America's Changing Demographics, and lamenting that the Vatican Council II never really penetrated into the Mexican Catholic community, and that Muslims are very much anti-Jewish, much more so than white Gentiles. So, you know, there's really three situations when you fast forward it. One is these groups within 80, 90 years become the demographic majority absolutely every Western country, and Jews are essentially forced to flee to Israel. They'll make Aliyah. They'll take their wealth with them. Much like what happened in Spain and Poland and various other places. And that will be something that the state of Israel will push for, as it does with birthright and any number of other institutions designed to bring you know, to really super populate the Middle East with ethnic Jews in order to retain strong control over the Middle East region demographically and Israel electorally. So, you know, that's one situation. And in that situation, you've essentially deserted the soil. So if you are an America-loving Jewish person like myself, that's a horrifying prospect. It's also killing the golden goose, so to speak, with respect to just how good Jews have it in the diaspora. I mean, never has there been anywhere in the world that Jews have prospered as in America, including Israel. Jews are much better off in America in terms of wealth, in terms of social status, in terms of protections in America than they are in Israel. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But so, you know, that's a horrible fate. The another way that this could end up demographically is, you know, there's the meme about the Jewish Asian overclass with a sort of mixed race underclass clicking sponsored content all day. I mean, that's sort of a humorous, humorous sort of meme, if you will, but it is certainly an option. And in that case, what you have is a bifurcation among Jews between big Jews and little Jews, right? You have the sort of millionaire, billionaire Jewish class who would be extremely well off in that globalist right. scenario. But then you'd have the underclass Jews who make up the majority of Jewish people, by the way, who are going to be, trampled underfoot, essentially, and then having to sort of purity spiral, you know, among each other to try to profess their Jewish identity louder and louder to try to make it to the top leadership of these, you know, this trillion dollar conglomerate, which is really what, you know, organized Jewish money is all in. I mean, you know, you got the JFNA, Jewish Federation of North America, has a $26 billion endowment. Then you got AIPAC, the JCRCs, you know, the ADL, Unite Israel Peel. I mean, you go on down the list, right? I mean, it's just, the amount of money is just almost unfathomable. I mean, it's really quite stunning. But, you know, that doesn't trickle down to, the Jewish tailor or the, you know, 70% of the Jewish population. And it's a horrible fate. I think any way you slice it, I'm not on board that. I want on board the America that I grew up in, the America that I was quite happy with when I was growing up as a kid, believing all of the doctrine, hearing that it was a white yeah. Christian nation.
Well, are you telling me that growing up in this white Christian nation wasn't terribly oppressive and you weren't, subject to anti-Semitism every day?
I'm trying to think now if I've ever in my life been subjected to anti-Semitism. One time, I don't think I've had one single incident in my entire life. Now, look, arguably, you could say that every time I log into Twitter or, if you want to count all the, you know, the internet meme comments, but that's so, you know, to me, that phrase is, if you're going to be intellectually honest, you have to get away, you have to do away with the phrase anti-Semitism altogether. That word is, it's a nuclear bomb. It's a word that is so overused, so abused, so toxic that to even use it, even in cases where it applies, is a form of intellectual dishonesty because of the dirty bomb aspect of it. There's so many associations, 99% of which are completely either unfounded at best or corrupt at worst. You know, I mean, there are lots of examples of anti-Semitism just being a pretext for covering up crimes, like the 2005 AIPAC espionage case, where AIPAC had prepared a case against the FBI to a public relations case to call them anti-Semitic if they move forward with the prosecution of these two AIPAC officials. And that only came out in discovery of an unrelated lawsuit. I mean, there's so many examples of this. But it's a trick, right? It's, I consider my job will be done when anti-Semitism carries as much, when anti-white carries as much, carries as heavy a social cost as anti-Semitism does.
Yeah, I want to go back real quick to something that you were touching on when I asked you about whether or not the actions of Jewish institutions actually benefit Jews overall. And one thing that I've noticed in Europe, there seems to be the beginning of a migration of Jews out of Europe. I don't think it's happening to a large extent at this point, but the actions of elite Jews and obviously non-Jewish globalists in Europe, namely bringing in large amounts of Muslims from the Middle East, from Africa as well, this has resulted in kind of a climate where there is a lot of anti-Semitism, and it's actual anti-Semitism, right? It's not a blogger critiquing the ADL. It's, you know, Jews in the street getting harassed by gangs of Muslims just because they're Jewish. And I think that would be, you know, definitely a good example of something that you were kind of talking about, in the sense that, yeah, there is an argument to be made that globalism and a lot of the diversity stuff, even that gets promulgated by elites, is not working out for the average Jew. Now, as a white identitarian, I'm not going to pretend to be terribly concerned with the plight of the average Jew, but I think that is an important angle to kind of dwell upon and explore.
Well, yeah, I mean, and we have representation, right? I mean, there's a reason that you don't need to be concerned about the plight of Jewish people, and that's because we have representation. We have a lobby. We have a legal defense fund. We have a legal offense fund. We have boots on the ground. I mean, we have all that. Like, there's, the common question you have growing up is it good for the Jews, right? It's kind of this cheeky question that's like a grandmother question, and it's something that's, you know, there's no question in the Jewish experience about whether or not you can ask, is it good for the Jews? And, you know, I mean, I think you and I both know that there's only one group that you can't ask, is it good for? And that needs to change. I mean, it's been 100 years at this point. And it's leading to genocide. It is. If you look, I mean, there's just simply no way around it. If the demographic situation were different, I would feel different. But yes, you know, when I hear you say that you're not terribly concerned about the plight of Jewish people, I think as well, you need not be. Jewish people are not concerned with the plight of the white Gentile. If anything, I would say that the totality of evidence suggests quite an inverse.
Right.
That the world would be better off if I think that the authoritarian personality published in 1950 by Adorno from the Frankfurt School is still very much the mainstream Jewish thought, that there's something inherently wrong with the German Anglo high testosterone personality, and not just high testosterone, but high social order, high nuclear family, high in-group preference, all of that stuff. I agree.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of slave morality, is that the Jews responsible for that, particularly those in the Frankfurt School, you know, they did a very critical analysis of what, you know, of the social technology that allowed the West to succeed. Right. And they pathologized that, and they, you know, they inverted the value system to make all of those things that are good and healthy and lead to, you know, good outcomes for the ethnic group practicing them, to flip that over so that they're actually bad things and they're spooky and they're off limits. And, you can't solely blame the Frankfurt School. Nevertheless, they did play a very large role in pathologizing these traditional healthy Western values. Values that the Jewish community quite often does promote.
Right. Well, there is two strands of the Jewish community that I do want to make sure that, you know, since we're talking about substance now, you know, there was this very instructive 1920 article by Winston Churchill called Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People, right? And that article, written in 1920, at the height of the power of the British Empire, right? This article, by Winston Churchill, no less, basically says there are two groups of Jews. One of them is good, one of them is evil, in his words. I mean, I mean, just check out the article and just look at the headings. I mean, he literally calls one of them, you know, sort of good Jews, and the other group bad Jews, terrorist Jews. I mean, he calls them the worst, you know, saying they're behind every evil from the 19th century and even the 17th century, including the French Revolution. He really gets into it. And this is 100 years ago that article was written. But it really does kind of touch on something that's still true to this day, which is that Jews are not monolithic in that way. And I think that the refrain that is often foisted onto Jews, mostly out of frustration, that Jews advocate for laws in the West that they do not advocate for in Israel, I think there is absolutely a partial truth to that. The other part of the truth, though, is that there is also very much a international Bolshevist Jewish individualist type, one who has no religion, who never had one, and is barely even sort of ethnically pro-Jewish, but just sort of abuses the Jewish identity group system to personally enrich him or herself off of it. And those type of Jews are actually sort of the number one enemy of Israel. I mean, Israel does not like George Right. Soros. Israel does not like J Street. J Street is the, for those who don't know, J Street is sort of the left-wing AIPAC. And by left-wing, I mean sort of Bolshevik as opposed to AIPAC, which is more Zionist. So they're really two different strategies. The cynic would say there are two different strategies about what's good for the Jews, which, you know, I think there may be something to that to some extent. But if you accept that, then you have to accept that there's sort of a group strategy to what whites are doing right now. Implicitly, that is, even when they're acting individually for their own gain, you know, doing what I call the kiss up, kick right. down tactic, which is when you, as a white person, you kiss up to the diversity industry above you for jobs, for promotions, for money, for status, but you kick down the white people underneath you. And it really leads to this sort of bottleneck, and a diminishing white middle class. Anyway, I can go on with this, but...
I just want to chime in real quick. I do agree with your analysis of, you know, the Jewish community at large, right? It's not... Jews don't constitute one monolithic group with the same positions on every issue. And furthermore, there are many Jews that do not act in their perceived Jewish interest. Now, there is a smaller category that opposes Zionism and, you know, right-wing Jewish policymaking and so forth because they think it's bad for the Jews. I think, I mean, there was an article in, I think it was the Jewish Daily Forward, perhaps it was Haaretz, but basically in the article, the author argued that the BDS boycott was actually, it wasn't good for Jews to oppose it. So that's an example of pretty much opposing something that seemingly is for the benefit of Jews, but for the benefit of Jews. And I think that's what you're kind of hitting at for a second there. But I think that category of, I think that mentality is pretty rare. I think it's generally Jews acting in their perceived ethnic interests, being pretty bold about it. And then on the other hand, you have the Soros type of Jews who they might not be totally against or opposed to Jewish ethnic interests, but you know, at the same time, many of them are the kind of the pink-haired SJW types that think Israel is illegitimate. They think that it's patriarchal, it's racist, and so forth. And they think that no country deserves to have borders or have control over, you know, exercise control over its immigration laws, which is really insane. But I don't think that those Jews are acting out of a sense of perceived Jewish interest. I think that they have just drank the progressive Kool-Aid, which, you know, Jews did play quite a disproportionate role in creating. But nevertheless, yeah, that isn't something that works in the benefit of Jews. And I think the conflict between internationalism and Zionism is quite interesting. I think that ties into what you were talking about with Marxism, Bolshevism and Zionism. I think internationalism or progressivism, globalism, is a bit more apt than Marxism or Bolshevism these days, although it does contain remnants or rather aspects of kind of the old left that have been kind of retconned or implemented by the internationalists to benefit what they're trying to do. The internationalists are more than anything else are concerned with creating international government, knocking down barriers between countries, be they economic or in the form of borders, right? There's a lot of overlap between Zionism and internationalism, but at the end of the day, that is the goal of internationalism, and Zionism is concerned with the state of Israel and the affairs of the Jewish people, and therefore it is a form of nationalism, and I think it is quite pesky for the internationalists. You do see conflict between internationalists and Israel increasingly, I would argue. People that argue that Zionists rule the world, Jews rule the world, and they all have one plan, and if you disagree with that, then you might be a secret Zionist too. I've had people accuse me of that in person once, actually. Yeah. It was very interesting. But I mean, like, the UN, and I believe America too, give quite a bit of money to Palestine. So if the Jews were one group always acting in their perceived ethnic interests, and they controlled the UN and America and the whole Western world, it would be very stupid of them to be giving their their enemies money. I think that's kind of what you're getting at to some extent, and I definitely agree. Jews are not one monolithic group, and we have to have more of a nuanced position on this if we want to see things clearly.
Yeah, I would also say that you would be shocked how many Jews are involved in the BDS movement. I mean, it's in many ways BDS is heavily Jewish on the J Street, George Soros side. And part of this is because, I consider the sort of left-wing Bolshevik Soros internationalist Jew to be an individualist by and large, and I consider the right-wing APAC Zionist Jew to be a collectivist by and large. And that's sort of generally it's not a perfect framework, but I think it's a lot more explanatory than any alternative that I've pieced together is in my own sort of mental tapestry of things. I think that's because you really have to understand that the people who are involved in these identity industry shakedowns from the left sort of Zionist Bolshevik perspective, they really do get very, very wealthy off of it. And it often is at the detriment of other Jews, but it's sort of done as an individualist, I'll get mine sort of thing. Like, you sure. Tend to see the people who are the Jews who are involved in BDS, for example, tend to be, here's sort of my framework. Like, people tend to get involved in the diversity industry as their personal path to power. Often, if they're only a C-list, if they're only like a C-grade engineer or a D-grade, teacher or, an E-level accountant, they can take the fast track to money, success, power, wealth, etc., by hijacking somebody else's identity movement, right? They may have been a middle-of-the-road accountant otherwise, but now they get to be the leader of a hugely funded identity politics group, and that's often at the expense of certain other Jewish organizations. Because of the Jewish strategy beginning in the 1950s, something called the Interfaith Coalition. So, we often think about the Jewish aspect of the diversity industry as being heavily involved in the African-American identity politics movement and the LGBT identity politics movement, and now to a certain extent, La Raza and Hispanic identity politics. But there's a second prong, which is that of the interfaith coalitions, that is Jewish influence over the Catholic Church through the Second Vatican Council, through the Christian Zionist organizations like Christians United for Israel, and ever increasingly the Muslim organizations. Jews, high-level Jews and high-level Muslims are very much on the same page politically in Europe and in Canada, and to a lesser extent, but still fairly solid extent in the United States. While there is sort of animosity between lower-level Muslims and lower-level Jews, which you see manifested in street violence, at the top level, there is a tremendous political coalition where you essentially see, you know, Jewish, Muslim bloc supporting for political parties that have a tremendous Jewish influence or leaders in, and in return, a sort of voting for immigration policies and social benefits for an ever increasing Muslim population. So it's this kind of high-low coalition against the middle, if right. you will, between Jews and Muslims, especially in Europe. Although, you know, this manifests itself with a fair amount of tension, right? Because, you know, Muslims get to a certain point in strength where they become, just through sheer strength of numbers, increasingly more powerful absent a tremendous amount of Jewish money. And you see this in UK politics with the rise of Jeremy Corbyn, the resurrection of Jeremy Corbyn, and being called anti-Semitic, you know, because he's now having to appeal to this, skyrocketing Muslim population. But then you also see this skyrocketing amount of Jewish investment in UK politics, which came out through a recent Al Jazeera video. So. Kind of a long-winded way of explaining the situation, but I hope that was clear.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. Well, Frame, we should take a break here in a minute, but before we do, I want to ask you, what are your thoughts on the state of Israel? Do you think it has the right to exist? Do you think we just need to perhaps change the relationship between Israel and America?
Yeah, I am totally okay with the state of Israel as it currently exists, except for one thing, AIPAC has to register as a foreign agent. I think that my perspective on Israel would, if we were in 1946 right now, I would have the opinion of many Jews around the world, which was that Israel's founding was tremendously controversial, and to displace like 700,000 Palestinians, to engage in terrorist warfare tactics as Israel did against Britain, any number of crimes over the years, from the Levant affair to stealing uranium to constant espionage, to war crimes in Gaza, to illegal settlements in the West Bank, to wars for Israel in Afghanistan, Libya, Lebanon. Iraq and now Syria and Iran, all these things, you know, which just so happened to basically protect the Golan Heights and other strategic interests of Israel. I mean, I could recite the litany of my beefs with Israel as a country. But my real concern is as an American. I mean, I got into this because, I guess I was duped into thinking that that American politics was about what's best for America. And silly me, I pursued that line right up until it bumped up into against my Jewish beliefs. You know, like if you believe in a free speech country, then all of this Jewish legislation with hate speech laws, with outlawing BDS, I mean, all of these insane, and with Bill 720, which was literally destroying the First Amendment. I would be okay with Israel, and I would actually love to support Israel if it just got the hell out of American politics. Just get out. Like, I visited Israel. I found it to be a tremendously spiritual experience. I have love for the Jewish people, and I think that while the founding conditions of Israel were certainly, you know, nothing short of conquest, you can say the same thing about most border border, the way most borders are drawn in the world. And once it's done, it's sort of done. And so I'm not going back in time and trying to question Israel's legitimacy. What I'm trying to do is call out the corruption. I mean, the Israel lobby is unbelievably powerful. I mean, at a level that if people only knew it, there would be an immediate call for an audit. So I say audit the Israel lobby. Audit it.
And that is something that I don't think you would have to convince our audience to too much to support. But let's go ahead and take a break here. Before we do, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you on the internet?
Sure. So you can find me on YouTube at Frame Game Radio. You can find me on Twitter at Frame Games and on Gab at Frame Games. Please make sure to, even though I'm more active on Twitter and I do frequent videos on YouTube, including a video series on the diversity industry, please do look me up on Gab as well, because we may not have much free speech on these mainstream platforms for much longer. So I want to do a shout out to Andrew Torba and the great platform that he created with Gab.ai.